This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. On Monday, the Wall Street Journal published a story based on a draft memo on torture that was prepared by lawyers at the Justice Department. U.S. law and international treaty prohibit torture under any circumstances, but the memo argued that the president's powers as commander-in-chief gave him intrinsic authority to override those restrictions. Since then, more documents have come to light, some that discuss some of the same points, others that discuss specific techniques, when they may be used, and with what specific authority. They also say that torture may be justified while interrogating members of Al-Qaeda. The first of the two key memoranda was written by the Justice Department in August of 2002. The second was prepared by the Defense Department in March 2003. If you want to read that memo, it's available on our website. You can go to www.npr.org. In testimony earlier this week to the Senate Judiciary Committee, Attorney General John Ashcroft said that President Bush has not directed or ordered any conduct that would violate the Constitution, the law, or international treaties, but critics charge that these memos may form the intellectual underpinning for the abuse of Iraqi detainees at Abu Ghraib prison. In a moment, what we know so far about where these memos came from, who's seen them, and what they've been used for. Later, we'll discuss the legal arguments. If you have questions about the memos, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now from his office in New York City is Jess Braven. He's the reporter with the Wall Street Journal who broke this story. And welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thanks, Neil.
When did the Justice Department start working on these arguments?
They started shortly after the 9/11 attacks. The Justice Department and the Bush administration as a whole considered the 9/11 attacks as a transformative event, not just politically, not just in terms of public safety, but legally, changing the footing on which the United States confronted its enemies around the world, and that it triggered a series of extraordinary war powers that the president could employ to protect the country.
And that was the basis of the argument that the president, under these circumstances of war, might be able to override what would normally be prohibited.
That's right. And we don't know precisely when that conclusion was first reached. But that idea was floating around even publicly in late September and October of 2001. There were quite public arguments that torture should be permitted under certain circumstances. You probably remember the Harvard Law professor Alan Dershowitz made such arguments, among others. So it's not that this was something that had not, in theory at least, been looked at publicly, but we didn't know then that the government was privately considering the specific legal arguments that the president could employ.
Now, how does that memo that we were talking about, the Justice Department memo, how, if at all, is that different from the one prepared by the Pentagon?
Well, they are related because the Pentagon memo, it relies on findings and opinions from the Office of Legal Counsel at the Justice Department for many of those conclusions about the Constitution and about the power of the Justice Department to prosecute people who might be accused of torture if they acted pursuant to a presidential directive. So the Defense Department and also the White House counsel all point to the Office of Legal Counsel and the Department of Justice as sort of the think tank where these ideas were developed.
And given that, there seems to be, in other words, there was a memo, it was the controlling document, and other things flowed from it.
That's right. I mean, there's not a huge number of people. There were a number of lawyers who work for these different agencies who met quite frequently on a lot of the law of war issues that have arisen since 9/11, including the detention of U.S. citizens and others without charge as enemy combatants, and the establishment of the Guantanamo Bay prison camp, and so forth. So many of these issues interrelate, and the power the president has employed to do these things usually has come without a direct grant from the Congress. In other words, there's not been any new legislation that says you can establish an offshore prison at Guantanamo, you mm-hmm. can disregard the United Nations Convention Against Torture, and so forth. Instead, all these attorneys have been giving a lot of thought to the inherent constitutional power the president has to wage war, something they say was affirmed by the Congress shortly after 9/11 with a resolution authorizing force to repel the al-Qaeda attack.
And as far as we know, what was the purpose of the memo? Was it a general theoretical discussion, or was there a case in point?
Well, the memos that we've seen are theoretical in the sense that they do not discuss using any of these techniques against a specific individual. And the Bush administration has stressed that these are, in the words of the Pentagon spokesman, scholarly exercises in which lawyers, as is their duty, explore all the conceivable hypothetical possibilities that might someday come into play, and that the actual stuff that they're doing does not approach these. So we can't say, we have no evidence that anyone was actually tortured or that the president ever issued any directives to disregard the laws forbidding torture, or that the president even saw these documents. We don't know that.
And so these are being portrayed as something along the lines of a Pentagon contingency plan for invasions of Canada or Mexico, but not something anybody was actually planning to do?
Well, I wouldn't say I wouldn't be flip about and say it was just, you know, for Canada and Mexico. I'd put it this way. The document that we wrote about on Monday, for example, the March 6, 2003 draft working group report on detainee interrogations in the global war on terrorism, assessment of legal, historical, policy, and operational considerations, the mandate that Secretary Rumsfeld gave, we're told, was to look at all those things and come up with a comprehensive assessment of what those issues involve, and that this legal theory sketching out the absolute outer bounds of presidential authority was something that the lawyers came up with. But it is safe to say that this view that the Bush administration lawyers took of presidential power would be far from unanimous among constitutional scholars and international law experts. It's, I would say it's a remarkable position that that would definitely be contested by many, many other reputable sources.
Well, we'll have a couple of experts debating those points in a few minutes, but I wanted to take a couple of calls with you, if you would. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And first, let's go to John, who's in Pawcatuck, Connecticut.
Hi. I'm calling up because this whole thing is bothering me. We seem to be going down an area that we've read about in history books. Are you saying that no one asked for this justification? It just kind of popped out of the, or was there really somebody who was generating interest in looking for ways around treaties and ways around the issue of torture? And I'll take my answer off the air if you don't mind.
Sure, John. Thanks for the call.
Sure.
Well, it's certainly, if you step back, you think about the idea that the chief lawyer at the Department of Defense, that top lawyers at the White House and the Justice Department are sitting around scratching their heads, looking through law books, trying to figure out when it might be lawful to torture people. That's quite a remarkable thought, and it illustrates the very strange and unhappy world we're in since 9/11. We don't know that someone said, I want to torture somebody, go get me the legal rationale under which I can do it. In other words, we don't know that that is what happened. We do know that interrogators complained that the al-Qaeda prisoners, or people they think are al-Qaeda prisoners, were not giving up information that they wanted using the techniques that the Army has been using for decades, techniques that were designed with Warsaw Pact, you know, Soviet-type armies in mind. So they wanted to say, well, what can we do? There is certainly a very ideological school of thought within the Bush administration that believes in an extremely strong executive power. And what better way to demonstrate how broad that power is than to show that it includes the ability to disregard laws prohibiting torture?
Another caller joins us now, Andre, who's with us from South Bend, Indiana.
Hi.
Hi.
We've been hearing a lot about Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. I also recently read about CIA interrogation centers at undisclosed locations around the globe. I'm wondering whether these memos or how they relate to those centers, what we know about those, and the legal status of those. And I'll take my answer off the air as well.
Okay, Andre, thank you.
Andre brings up a very good point, is that when we listen to the U.S. government explain what these different things mean, we have to listen to the words very carefully. This is a report that refers to the global war on terrorism, something that the administration has defined as including Afghanistan and Guantanamo, but not Iraq, at least legally speaking, because legally speaking, they concede that the Geneva Conventions apply to Iraq. They say they don't apply to the war on terrorism because terrorists are not a state, and a state has not signed the Geneva Conventions. This report was prepared for the Defense Department, and therefore it apparently governs what the Defense Department does. There are what is now known as OGA, which is a new euphemism for CIA, other government agencies, and they have their own legal shop, and they have their own facilities, and they operate under a somewhat different legal paradigm. Military forces operate under the Uniform Code of Military Justice and certain other statutes that affect the armed forces. The CIA is a civilian agency, and therefore different laws apply to it. Does the CIA have a different legal guidance than this? Does it have a different set of interrogation techniques that it's using? We don't know.
Today you also reported, Jess Braven, that the Defense Secretary, Donald Rumsfeld, approved a specific list of interrogation methods for prisoners at Guantanamo Bay. What can you tell us about that?
Sure. In late 2002, there was, the government says, a spike in chatter. That's, I guess, the terms they use, suggesting that an Al-Qaeda attack might be imminent. They had a number of prisoners, one or two, at Guantanamo who they thought were top Al-Qaeda conspirators who might have information about this attack.
This was at a time, I think, the alert level went to orange.
That's right. And the interrogators at Guantanamo complained they just were not getting anything out of these guys, and they tried a number of different techniques. Now, there are a number of stories that we've heard about what techniques were included, but we do know, and this is what we reported today, that in December of 2002, Secretary Rumsfeld approved a list of techniques, some of which are not included in existing Army doctrine. Those techniques raised concerns among some senior military lawyers that they were not part of doctrine. They did not meet Geneva Convention standards, and therefore there was and that concern led Rumsfeld to ask for the review that led to the March 2003 draft that we reported Monday. I know it's a very complicated sequence. But anyway, those techniques that we described today were only authorized for about a month, from the middle of December, when Rumsfeld first said, okay, do all these things to get what we need to know about this attack, you are authorized to do these things to find out what we need to know. And then in January, he suspended the ones that were not already part of military doctrine pending this review that led to the memo that, among other things, described the potential legal justification for disregarding the torture statute.
And after that, were they reimposed?
Some of them, that's the thing. The next step is a new set of interrogation techniques, about two dozen, we're told, were approved by Rumsfeld in April of 2003. But that list, the government says, is classified, and they won't tell us what they are. But we should say that they insist that they are all humane, that they don't go anywhere near approaching torture, and that's been their point. They say that, sure, there's a legal justification that some lawyers, you know, thought up about what might be allowed under some circumstance, but they say that the way they actually interrogate prisoners is humane and respectful of human dignity and so forth and so on.
And one important element, we just have a few seconds left, but one important element with these techniques, at least as described in your article, is that specific authorization from superiors is required every time they did something as relatively minor in terms of escalation as a poking an interrogee in the chest.
That's true. However, you should remember that poking someone in the chest is legally defined as assault. In fact, it's a battery. So, you know, you're not allowed to poke prisoners in the chest under the normal Uniform Code of Military Justice. Police are not allowed to poke people or push them around. It's considered an assault. So that's why that might require a special kind of justification under these circumstances. But you're right. I think it's fair to say that some of the techniques that are on these super secret lists that the government is so reluctant to reveal to us don't perhaps look that bad. Some might seem a bit more severe.
Jess Braven, thank you very much.
Sure thing.
Jess Braven, reporter for The Wall Street Journal. He broke this story last Monday. He joined us on the phone from his office in New York. The legal arguments when we come back from a break. This is NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about how leaked government memos show that the Bush administration was thinking about the president's powers and whether he is authorized to override both U.S. law, the Constitution, and international treaty on the question of torture. What are your opinions about and your questions about how U.S. policy toward prisoners is determined about U.S. law, the Constitution, and the Geneva Convention? Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now to talk about the legal arguments presented in the memos and whether or not there's ever circumstances under which torture is justified, we're joined now by two legal scholars. Doug Kamek is chair and professor of constitutional law at Pepperdine University in Malibu, California. He's also served President Ronald Reagan as head of the Office of Legal Counsel, and Doug Kamek joins us from his office in Malibu. And Professor Kamek, good to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Yeah, good to be with you.
Also with us is Diane Orentlicker, a professor of international law at American University in Washington. She's with us from her office here in Washington. Welcome back to you as well.
Good to be back with you.
Doug Kamek, let's begin with you. From what you've seen of these memos, do they justify torture?
No, I don't think they do. I think what the memos do is something that the Office of Legal Counsel does regularly, and that is try to give guidance to high-level decision-makers about what the existing legal parameters are, what the minimum and maximum scope of legal authority is under given circumstances. And while they can be read out of that context to suggest that the president need not always abide by specific statutes in cases of grave emergency and unforeseen conditions, that's not a startling proposition. Abraham Lincoln relied upon it to suspend the writ of habeas corpus and to issue the Emancipation Proclamation. The Supreme Court has hinted in the prize cases and in other cases that the president has pretty dramatic authority in the context of a 9/11-type emergency or in the context of trying to avoid another 9/11. And given that, I think the Office of Legal Counsel's advice and the working group's memorandum has to be understood as qualified by that type of context.
Diane Orentlicker, do you agree? I mean, are these simply hypothetical?
I don't agree. Of course, we don't know what happened after the draft memorandum was adopted, and it's quite important to clarify what happened with that. But Mr. Braven's report in the Wall Street Journal indicates that the final version of this looked substantially like the version that's been now publicly leaked. And that version, for the most part, Neil, is a detailed manual for how to evade U.S. laws prohibiting torture. And it proposes, as you suggested in your summary of the report, a rather extraordinary claim that when the president exercises his powers as commander-in-chief, he's literally above the law. I mean, the claim really is that strong. And finally, what sort of pulls this all together as a quite extravagant and radical claim is that the president's commander-in-chief powers are defined in the context of the endless war on terror. And in that respect, the legal argument extends well beyond the constitutional precedents that we've seen before, which involved an imminent and fairly classic armed attack against the United States. Here we're talking about the claim that the president, in combating an endless war against terror, is literally above the laws enacted by Congress.
Doug Kamek, you don't see the argument as being framed that way.
Well, I don't, but I would share this concern. From the draft that I've read, I think it is somewhat unpolished as a draft. I think it does not make as clear as I would make it if I was drafting it that the claims for extraordinary powers would have to be hinged on extraordinary circumstances, the kind of Lincoln-esque circumstances that I referenced before. And those things are well settled in the law. And it's not that the president is above the law. He's basically making the claim here, or his lawyers are exploring to what degree the Constitution as a law would necessarily have to limit the scope of treaty obligation or customary international law or statute. And, of course, that is a commonplace feature of our system, and that is that the Constitution is a higher law and these other provisions are always construed in accordance with it. And the other thing, Neil, that I think is important to point out about these documents is that a good deal of this is just ground clearing. What are the relevant statutes that apply? What are the relevant conventions that apply? And along the way, the document says quite unequivocally, malicious and sadistic use of force always violates contemporary standards of decency and would constitute cruel and unusual punishment. And also tells enlisted men that they have no constitutional justification or lawful justification to obey an unlawful order. So a good deal of what has to be said was said in this memo, and I think the explorations of maximum power have to be hinged on extraordinary circumstance.
Neil, could I interject here? I read the memo somewhat different in the extent to which it provides advice versus laying out all the arguments. Most of the memorandum, the part that seems to draw on previous Department of Justice memoranda, push the limits of the prohibition on torture. They don't neutrally explore the law. They advocate a rather extravagant interpretation of how to evade the law with a clear eye toward justifying torture. There is a section at the end which is written in a different tenor, and it seems to be written by military lawyers because that final section, which I believe is headed under the rubric of policy considerations, does affirm American values and laws against torture, but it seems to be written in a very different voice.
Let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. Naina joins us from Portland, Oregon.
Well, hello.
Hi.
My question is sort of two-pronged. The first part is, as Americans, what safeguards exist to protect us when powers like this are invoked? Is it just a case of breaking eggs to make the omelet and we get to suck it up? And the second part is, if we are going to, or if our leaders are going to invoke powers that allow them to at least partly disregard international agreements, what should we expect from foreign states when they, or non-state entities when they have their hands on our people?
Doug Kamek?
Well, that's an excellent question, and let me take it in the reverse order. First of all, I don't think, again, this memorandum is advocating torture. I think it's trying to lay out what the international agreements say is torture. And again, the words of the international agreement is that it's severe physical or mental pain or suffering, referring to prolonged mental harm by threats of physical harm or threats of death. And that's a far cry from the kinds of things that thus far, at least, seem to have been talked about in the context of Abu Ghraib. That's not to say that the legal considerations justified Abu Ghraib. They don't, but it is to say that there's nothing in the memo that advocates torture that would violate the international convention. As to your first question, which is who checks the president if he is the ultimate determiner of constitutional meaning and constitutional value, this has been a question that the Supreme Court has before it at the moment and has not answered very well and has generally only answered after wartime has concluded, which is one of the perplexing things, as my colleague mentioned before, about the war on terror is we don't know when its conclusion is.
And when you say that it's before the Supreme Court, this on the question of detention of U.S. citizens without charge.
Both the Hamdi and Padilla case, which are U.S. citizens, as well as the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court over the detainees in Guantanamo.
Diane, did you want to address Naina's question?
Well, I would like to say one thing about the law that has been established for some time. The Supreme Court has said that even when the president is exercising his authorities as commander-in-chief in wartime, his authority is at its lowest ebb when he acts in contradiction to the will of Congress. And this memorandum explores in detail how the president might legally justify circumventing laws enacted by Congress. And we keep talking about international laws. There are violations of international laws argued here. But at the what I think is most surprising about this memorandum is that it seeks to justify a violation of congressional laws. And in terms of the
just to interject, Diane Ortlicker, as treaties are ratified, the U.S. Congress passes laws to incorporate those treaties into U.S. law.
That's right. And this memorandum acknowledges that there's potential exposure under one of those implementing laws involving torture.
Mm-hmm.
And then pursues a number of quite extraordinary legal arguments, which if my students made them on an exam, I'd probably flunk them for it, to justify the non-application of those laws in the case of torture of people suspected of terrorism.
Naina, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Let's go now to Skip, and Skip's on the line with us from Kansas City.
Hi, how you doing?
Okay.
I'm just wondering how we keep talking about laws and the protection of people's rights and everything, but how do we deal with someone who doesn't stand for any national values or any national agenda or isn't covered by any national law? And
you're speaking of Al-Qaeda in that context.
Well, I mean, you know, when 9/11 happened, somehow in our world we crossed a line. At least as far as this nation is concerned. And I realize that that line has been crossed many, many times in the Middle East, but it was the first time it was brought to our shores, or maybe not the first time, but at least it was something that really, really got our attention. And, you know, Biden was talking the other day about addressing Mr. Ashcroft about, you know, his son, and he didn't want his son tortured. And my question was, you know, if Mr. Biden's son were in a situation where Al-Qaeda or someone from a terrorist organization were threatening to kill him, how far would Mr. Biden be willing to go to protect his son?
Diane Ortlicker, that's a question. One of the things the memos appear to address is if they thought somebody had information about an impending 9/11-style attack, maybe that's the circumstance that might justify this.
You know, I think that particular argument, while it's persuasive theoretically, is a red herring. We just don't have proof that torture works to save lives, and on the contrary, military interrogators are convinced, based on decades of experience, that torture produces unreliable results. And it has the further very detrimental effect of recruiting terrorists. That is, the images of American abuse that have been broadcast around the world have, alas, been one of the best recruiting devices for Al-Qaeda. So torture just doesn't work.
Neil, where does your guest, where she live?
Washington, D.C.
Washington, D.C. And if some terrorists were to place a nuclear weapon in Washington, D.C., and our CIA people had captured some of the terrorists that were making this plot possible, and those people had codes to stop that nuclear bomb from detonating, how would she feel about what lengths the CIA or some other...
I think we get the thrust of your question, Skip. Diane?
I mean, I think I've answered the question the best I can, which is that particular hypothetical is sort of appealing to everyone, but it's not the situation that this particular set of legal memoranda address. They address a much more hypothetical, very vague set of circumstances. If anyone I loved were in the hands of terrorists, I would assume that they could protect themselves. The law is quite clear that you can defend yourselves. But
why are you naive?
It goes way, way beyond that. And if I could say, in response to the argument that Al-Qaeda doesn't violate these rules, my goodness, if we start letting Al-Qaeda set our standards for behavior, whether constitutional or otherwise, we're in big trouble as a country.
We're talking about the leaked Justice Department and Pentagon memos addressing the issues around torture and presidential power. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's get another caller on the line. This is Lynn, who's with us from Salt Lake City.
Hello.
Hi.
It seems to me as though Rumsfeld and Bush's response when the Abu Ghraib situation was publicized was to say this is un-American and therefore immoral. And now, as I understand it, that the media has pointed out that maybe they didn't order it, but they've allowed it and authorized it to the extent that they haven't stopped it, it seems to me that their response is that it's moral because they've authorized it. And my question is, do you think the public in general is capable of noticing the switch? And if they are capable of noticing this change, why aren't they saying, no, we're not complete fools, we won't just believe one thing one day and the next thing believe the opposite?
Well, let's get to Doug Kamek and ask if you see any contradiction between these memos prepared by government officials and what the Secretary of Defense and the President said after Abu Ghraib.
I don't, because I think what the President has said and has authorized is humane treatment in his executive order creating military tribunals. His directive is to provide for humane conditions of confinement where those who are detained receive adequate food, clothing, shelter, and medical care, and that reasonable steps are taken to guarantee their safety. That's the President's direction. So to this memorandum, the Department of Defense Working Group memorandum points out that the Eighth Amendment protections against cruel and unusual punishment, which are used to interpret the meaning of various provisions of the 1994 Convention Against Torture, are understood to mean the same thing. So I would hope that people would read Mr. Braven's work carefully, because as he said carefully on your program just a minute ago, Neil, is that there is nothing in these documents that is authorizing torture, that is making a claim that there's presidential power to give that authority, or that it is morally justified. Quite the contrary. What they are doing is providing for what I think Skip alluded to, and that is the extraordinary circumstance that we would face another 9/11 and what would be the maximum extent of the president's power in that regard. And one last thing about Diane failing one of her students. If, in fact, the Congress of the United States passed a statute that directly and explicitly repealed one of the president's authorities, say his ability to veto legislation, both of us would, I think, readily agree that the fact that they passed the statute unanimously would not make it law, that the Constitution would govern. And so we're in that kind of discussion here. We're in the discussion of what if, after hundreds of years of conceding that the president is commander-in-chief, that he has full control over tactical decisions of the military.
I'm afraid we're just going to have to leave it there. Doug Kamek and Diane Orentlicker, thank you both very much. More after a break.